If you're gonna tell me your life story, why don't you sit down?
I'm Steve Vinson, that's Paul Schultz. This is the Rough Draft Podcast. Thanks for joining us. We have a very special guest this week. It marks the first time we've had an actual professional writer on the show.
When is that person getting here?
Very excited to have MP Cavalier on this week. And I'm assuming you go by MP Cavalier on all your podcasts.
I do.
Okay. Welcome to the show. This is a little something we call Rough Draft. And like we were talking before the show, this is our third episode, so we don't know.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
It's a milestone.
I think we can make it to five. Mm-hmm. You know, he asked me, Paul, he asked me when he gets here, he's like, I have to admit, I haven't listened to the show really, so I don't know what the format is. I was like, I don't know what it is either, so with any luck, we'll figure it out together. That having been said, what we've been doing is, let's just tell you what the show is, what we think the show might be about. Is writing, the process of writing, the outcomes of writing. Paul and I, you know, as I alluded a minute ago, Paul's the closest thing to a professional writer I've ever known, because you actually get paid to write. Is that the definition of professional writing? I think so. You've been paid to write. I don't know. You don't.
Not much, and not recently.
Yeah. A former professional writer.
Yeah.
But Paul, do you write for any of the comic books, or do you just do the easy part? You do the art.
I write and draw Serial Squad.
And you presumably have sold books.
Yeah. I've made money off of them. Yes.
There you go. You're a pro. You can't enter the comic book Olympics now.
No, unfortunately, I can enter the comic book Special Olympics, but not the comic book Olympics.
Right. I always maintain that I've done my worst writing when I was getting paid for it, and I've always done my best writing when I assumed that I was the only person that was going to read what I was writing.
That is a fantastic intro to what I think the theme was going to be this week, which is when is the best time to write.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess first, let's start with, for our listeners that don't know the great MP Cavalier, first of all,
what is he getting here?
You have to go over to don'tpanicradioshow.com in a week after I've registered that domain. Hey, maybe I'll have it by the time this show comes out. Hey, I know it's available.
So
I just haven't registered yet. Go over to don'tpanicradioshow.com and we'll have a link to doitindieradiohour.com, and you can introduce yourself to the great MP, or just listen to any random Don't Panic radio show episode in which you'll hear us talking about MP. Like every single episode, we figure out a way to get it in.
I appreciate all the free publicity that I get on your show.
Hey, that adds three or four people to the list of people who know who you are.
Thank you.
My wife, Superfan James.
My wife.
Yeah, I mean,
that's okay.
I don't know who Gary is. Yeah. MP's wife.
Yeah.
So far, our mothers don't listen to the show, so you know we're still all safe.
They can listen to this one if they want. MP's mom listens to every show he does.
And
he
says my mom is a super fan. The Radio Hour. Yeah.
How does that even work? How do you get your mom to?
I think she just likes to hear my voice because I live so far away.
Good point.
So I think she just tunes in to hear my voice. I don't know how big of a coup d'etat fan she might be, but
if she ever met the butcher guy that plays drums,
yeah,
she'd be a huge fan.
Yeah, but that first 20 minutes, she's tuned in for sure.
That's great. My mom may someday listen, but she hates the F word, and so
yeah,
I would point her to this show. I do from time to time use it. Not nearly as much, and mostly in my writing. So I don't know if I want that, though.
I think that we're at the age where if our moms aren't okay with us using salty language.
Yeah.
They probably didn't raise us right.
Okay. Well, I was waiting for the second half of that.
I mean, I don't use it in front of her. Yeah, I mean, I don't, I don't sit there, you know, over a salami sandwich with my mom and say, Mom, this is really good fucking salami. But
that's when your mom says, watch your goddamn mouth. There's a fucking baby in the room.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm respectful, but I am now 50 years old, and if I want to fly an F-bomb out there with her with an earshot, I think it's okay.
Light up a doob.
Is she going to punish me? You know, I'm grounded? Great. I don't have to go to work tomorrow.
What are you going to do now, MP? Or your mom call you MP? What are you going to do? What are you going to do now, MP? You're like, I'm going to light up this fucking dude.
Yeah.
Fucking get high.
You can either stand there bitching about it or join me. So this is about writing, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
don't panic. The show is about writing.
Don't panic the show. What would you say? What's your relationship to writing? When did you first start writing? Why did you first start writing?
I've been writing since I was probably 6 or 7 is when I first got my head around the fact that I could put a couple of words together and form a sentence that was mine. And then when I was probably in high school, I went through all the crap that kids go through in high school. So writing was a thing that I could do that I knew that nobody else would see, that I could go home and I could sit at my dad's electric typewriter, which was awesome, a Smith Corona electric typewriter. And I could kind of write these manifestos about, you know, how much I hated that asshole in my gym class, or how much I loved the new, you know, Who record, or, you know, the stuff that you think about when you're just kind of coming of age. Mm-hmm. And then at some point, I guess in high school or college, I decided that may be what I kind of wanted to do. But the grim realities of it were I like stuff and I got to get a real job. So writing became a secondary thing. And one of the funny thing was about that part of my life is when I actually went out into the workforce, I worked at a help desk overnights for the first 2 years of that job. So there was nothing to do.
Oh.
So I did a crap ton of writing. Like I filled notebooks with just stuff about music and stuff about, you know, living in New York City and, you know, all this stuff. And it's all horrible. It's poorly written and poorly thought out and, you know, using, like I'm doing right now, you know, using 50 words where 3 would have done just fine. But at least I was getting it out there and I was learning how to write. And I was working at the Associated Press at the time. And literally 20 feet from where I was sitting were some of the best journalists in the world. And I would kind of hang out with them. And everybody's working an overnight shift, so there's not a lot to do. So, you know, you're sitting in the cafeteria with these guys and say, hey, can you do me a favor and kind of critique this piece of writing I did? And, you know, but everything at that point is at the by the AP style book. And they're all trained to write for The Wire. And I'm writing for, you know, in my head, I'm writing for Rolling Stone magazine, man.
Yeah.
So one day I ran into probably one of my favorite writers of all time. I ran into David Frick on the street. He's been a music journalist since I can remember, and he was working across the street. Rolling Stone's office was across the street, and I ran into him on 51st Street, and he talked to me for like 20 minutes just about writing, and we were actually both going to the same show that week. I can't remember what band it was, and he gave me some really good advice about writing, and he said, listen, you already know how hard it's going to be to break in, and you already know how hard it is to be a writer. He said, he said, you got to write for yourself. He said, don't worry about getting paid. That'll come, but it's going to be an uphill struggle. And then, you know, like we all say, you know, life happened, you know, I got, you know, I had to kind of figure out what I wanted to do with my life and whether I wanted to starve or whether I wanted to eat. And I decided to eat a lot. And, I just kind of kept doing writing as a thing that I just like to do, and I never considered myself a writer. I always considered myself a person who writes. I don't have any training. I don't have any. I've never been seriously critiqued. I've never taken a class because I don't want to be critiqued. Because you know, you're always afraid of what somebody who supposedly knows how to write is going to say. You know, this is not very good, or you need to do this. And what I said earlier about the worst writing I've ever done is the writing I got paid for. It's because I was writing what someone told me to write and then making the edits that they told me to make and putting in words and phrases that I wouldn't use. So I just said, you know what? I'm going to be okay not ever getting paid for this. I just like the exercise of it. Mm. I just like to sit down, you know, now at a, you know, a laptop computer and write whatever comes into my head and then be my own editor. And, you know, thank God for the internet. You just kind of put it out there. And if someone reads it and likes it, then you get that feedback. And if they don't, they don't.
Yeah.
And if they read it and hate it, you get that feedback too. And fortunately, I've been on both sides of that spectrum where folks have said, you know, I really like what you wrote and I like the way you wrote it. And I've also been at a point where someone said, I read what you wrote and I think you're an asshole. And we could, so let's have that conversation.
Yeah. So the critique you've gotten is more on the content and less on the, I don't know what you're trying to say because I can't, you're writing like a third grader with a crayon.
Yeah, I've critiqued myself that way. I've mm-hmm. never been told by an outsider, you know, your writing is crap. Mm-hmm. I don't even understand what you're trying to say. I think if someone were to say that to me, I would kind of have to question their literacy. Yeah. I sometimes go down a dark path with words, and I sometimes tend to use words that maybe I don't need to use, but I want the writing to stand out.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that I want people to be challenged mm-hmm. by not just by what I write. I want people to be challenged by any art mm-hmm. to say, I don't understand what that word means. I don't understand what that lyric says. I don't understand what this picture is trying to tell me. I need to go and find out what it means to me mm-hmm. or read it again or look at it again or listen to it again.
Have a conversation with somebody about it.
What do you think this means? Yeah. Which I think is the crux of any art or critique or music critique or any critique is to ask other people, what do you think, what does this mean to you?
Yeah.
And I think that depending on what it means to you, you're either going to like it or you're going to hate it.
Yeah.
Hopefully somewhere in between.
That aspect of art has always been interesting to me, and I think I'm of two minds. I'm like a two-face when it comes to that, because sometimes I go, well, the purpose of art is to elicit an emotion, a reaction, a something in another person. And then other times I go, no, the purpose of art is just to be art.
I always found that to be a very bullshit attitude. The first, the former, not the latter. I agree with the second thing you said.
I'm okay with the first one as long as the artist is okay with not having any control over what that reaction will be.
Yeah.
If you put something out into the world and you say, I hope this gets a reaction, I don't know what it will be. Mm-hmm. I don't know what emotions. I know the emotions I had when I created it and that I have when I go back and experience it, but I don't know what other people... Because I heard an artist one time say... I'm not responsible for what your reaction to my art is. And I'm like, well, you're totally responsible. They might have had a reaction that was different from what you wanted it to be, but that's okay. I guess, so yeah, the bullshit ones is when they go, man, this represents man's struggle and man's struggle for, you know, all the struggles that man encounters along the path. And I want people to see it and realize they're not alone, mm-hmm. man, unless they're old white dudes. And then I want them to feel totally alone,
right.
man.
It's a little broad.
Yeah. And then that's another podcast. Every single old white dude feels totally alone right now.
Right.
That's why they've all voted for Trump. I mentioned Trump in a podcast. That's weird.
It's so weird. That never happens.
It's so weird. So you're writing... You write for you. You write for challenging people. You write for... The funny thing is, I liked another thing you said, where you said, somebody said, I don't understand your writing, or it looks like it was written by a kangaroo in the middle of the Australian bush with a dried-up Sharpie.
Get that kangaroo a contract.
Yeah. Then you would question their literacy. I would question their motives, you know?
It's snarkier to question their literacy.
Yes,
it's very easy for when someone gives you negative feedback, which is great.
Yeah.
But if they're giving you negative feedback, like I don't understand what this says, or you're wrong, or what are you even talking about? And I've gotten feedback like
poorly
that.
Written.
I could mm-hmm. Poorly written. And there's two ways. There's three things you can get. You can say thanks for the feedback. I really appreciate that. Duly noted. Or are you sure you kind of understood what the context was? Or you could say, do you even know how to read? Which to me is the end is the end of the conversation. Yeah. And I could go off and write a snarky treatise about them.
I love that kind of confidence, because it doesn't come from a place of arrogance or conceit or anything like that. It's just when you get so comfortable with a skill or an attribute or a character trait that you have, that you know if somebody says it's not good, you know they've got something else going on. Mm-hmm. And I think if human beings could develop one or two of those in their lifetime, where, and I'm not talking about the kind of confidence you see from, you know, stars or celebrities or assholes. Mm. I'm talking about that confidence. It's just like, no, it's not from a place of me trying to pump up my own ego.
Right.
It's not from ego. It's just that I know that I have that skill.
Yeah.
So how about this? If you would be so kind, I believe you brought a couple of pieces that you've written.
Yeah, this is really weird for me. So I never asked to read what I wrote out loud.
Nice.
So yeah, I did. You guys were not, first of all, I didn't properly thank you guys for inviting me on the show, because writing is like the fourth thing that I do when I have time to write. Mm. And to be asked to come on to this podcast and talk about my writing, thank you very much. I'm flattered. I appreciate that.
It's our honor.
So I went, after you invited me, I went and learned how to write, and I wrote a couple of things and brought them with me.
Shit, I better write some.
I better write something.
Also, he gets to be the first one to do a live reading.
Oh, yeah.
Because everything up to this point has been, you know, previously recorded. So no pressure.
What would have been good is if you had said that after he got done reading it.
I can splice it in later.
No, I don't mean that.
It's too late now.
It's too late now.
Now I'm like, oh,
we might lose him.
I'm walking in new snow. Oh. So I brought two things with me. It's very, obviously, this is such a hard exercise for a non-seasoned writer, a person who writes. When I finish writing something and I make all my changes and I make all my edits and everything and I just kind of push it out there, whether it's on a blog or whether it's on someone's website or whether it's on Facebook, you know, wherever I'm putting this stuff, I usually don't ever go back to it. So when you guys said, hey, can you bring something on the podcast to read? I'm sitting there going, I better start going through notebooks. I literally like went into the basement and pulled out all of the notebooks from, you know, when I was like 25 years old and the stuff that I wrote on my blog back in 2005 and all these things. I'm like, what can I possibly read that will read like a piece of writing and not read like me being pissed off about something or me being really elated about something, which is never good writing. So I thought if I could bring something that was a little bit, you know, writing like most art is an emotional exercise. So I brought something that made me very sad when I wrote it, and I wrote something that really made me laugh when I wrote it. So I'll read the sad one first.
And then you'll bring us back up.
And then we'll shoot the shit for a while, and then if we have time, I'll read the, because okay, the other one's a little bit longer. So this is, at the timing of this is actually kind of amazing, because tonight, I guess they have the Grammy Awards tonight.
Oh, do they?
And by some weird twist of I don't know what, they're giving out their Lifetime Achievement Awards, as they do every year, and they usually give it to six or seven artists or producers or whatever, and one of the recipients of the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award tonight is the Velvet Underground.
Wow.
Which blows my mind, because completely villainized throughout their entire career by the industry, who didn't want to have anything to do with them. Industry people in the 60s wanted this band shut down. The owner of the president and CEO of their record label wanted them removed from the label, along with all of the other avant-garde artists like Zappa and people like that. Zappa and the Velvet Underground were label mates at one time, and he wanted them all gone.
Wow.
And, you know, they've never been a mainstream band, but the famous quote from Brian Eno is that their first album only ever sold 30,000 copies, and every single person that bought one started a band. So their influence is huge. So I think for the first time in probably 25 years, I might actually watch the Grammys tonight. A, just to see, just to hear them say the Velvet Underground on a Grammy broadcast. But I know that two of them are still alive. Mo Tucker, the drummer, and John Cale are still alive. So I'm kind of wondering if they're going to show up for this ass slap fest that is the Grammys, just to see them hobnob with Beyonce and Adele. I just want to see that.
That's amazing. If they do, I'll be surprised. Yeah. But
I may wait till tomorrow and just watch the clip. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I could sit through a 3-hour Grammy-thon.
I'd love for them to get up and do a speech about how you hated us for all these years.
And that's which is exactly what
this an apology tour?
Yeah, which is exactly what would be expected. And I know that Lou Reed is probably rolling over in his... He's either rolling over in his grave or laughing his ass off. But I think Lou Reed is probably rolling over in his grave. So with them getting inducted into the Hall of Fame tonight, I remember that when Lou Reed died back in 2013... I'm not like a hero worship guy. You know, I don't cry when Mike Schmidt retires from the Philadelphia Phillies or, you know, there's been very, very, very few instances in my life where the death of an artist really, really got to me. Mm-hmm. And Lou Reed was one of those, maybe two or three, John Lennon being the other one and Hunter S. Thompson. Mm-hmm. So when Lou Reed died, I just kind of sat down and said, I need to just, you know, write something to get it out. But at right around the same time that Lou Reed passed away, a very, very famous New York disc jockey named Dave Herman, and just saying his name kind of fills my throat with bile, passed away also. Dave Herman was a big hero of mine growing up, and it turned out that he was a pedophile. Oh, and God. When he died, he was awaiting, I think he was awaiting trial on multiple charges of some really, really messed up stuff. Like he was having like teenage girls shipped to Hawaii for his pleasure. And I was like, I grew up hearing this guy's voice every day and loved him. Mm-hmm. So it was this weird kind of mix of Lou Reed's dead and people hated him. I loved him. And Dave Herman, people loved him. And now I hate him.
Yeah. You
know? So wow. I wrote not an obituary, but just a memory of a very specific day, a very specific time of day when I was a kid. This is from October of 2013. I was probably 9 or 10 years old. I feel like this is the Diane Rehm show right now.
Oh, will you read from your new book, which is called The Drunker I Get, the Better You Sound?
That's the best Diane Rehm I could do.
Hello, this is a way with words. No, wait. Yeah. What is this? This is the delicious words.
Yeah, this will be in my new book, which is called Me Make Words Now.
We have to introduce ourselves.
Right.
My name is Chesterfield Station. Mm-hmm. I'm joined by Alistair Powers, and we have MP Cavalier here to read a few words. You're listening to The Delicious Word.
Nice. Thank you. I was probably 9 or 10 years old the first time I heard Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed. It was the mid-70s, and I had two teenage brothers, and we lived in New York City, so there was always a radio tuned to WNEW 102.7 FM. I remember it being a summer weekday morning. I was free of school and too young to have a job. We lived on Coney Island, steps from the Atlantic Ocean and the famous boardwalk. Even from the high-rise windows of our apartment, it felt like you could reach out and touch the hot sand. You could certainly taste the salt water in the air. I didn't yet understand the graphic sexual language of Walk on the Wild Side, so I honed in on its music. Its stand-up bass line synced with the rhythm of the early morning tide, their short waves rising and crashing to the shore. Those bone-chilling violins were like the Atlantic wind whistling through the girders of the cyclone roller coaster. The gyrating doot-de-doos of the thunder thighs. It would be a few years before I could analogize those. Walk on the Wild Side was among the first rock and roll songs to stick in my head for the long run. A few years later, mired deeply in a predictable Kiss fixation, I never pretended that they lived in anything but a world of sexual fantasy. But Walk on the Wild Side, that was a piece of New York City's street reality. That was the New York I wanted to observe as I got older. It didn't sound romantic or enticing, but it sounded so real. And kids need reality, because this is a fucked up and cruel world that sometimes seems to be aligned against them in unimaginable ways. I'm not into hero worship. My dad was my only hero. But I have been inspired and enlightened by many authors, artists, and musicians. So when Lou Reed passed away, quietly and with dignity, I briefly reflected on that moment almost 4 decades ago when I first heard his voice. And then I was reminded by the other voice I heard come out of the radio that day. That voice inspired me in other ways. It sparked my interest in radio. I would hear that voice over the years, interviewing some of the most brilliant musicians of my generation and introducing the songs that would become part of the soundtrack of my life. That was the voice that told me that John Lennon was dead. And this weekend, he died as well. But his death, sadly, is merely a symbolic one and most undignified. And his entire legacy is now but a mere footnote to his long-held dark secret. I'm not into hero worship because heroes can let you down. I'll always have Walk on the Wild Side, and thank goodness for that, because adults need reality too.
It was sad.
That was a sad day.
Yeah. Paul? You got something in your eye?
I'm going to need a minute. No, seriously, that was very well done.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. The next one is funnier, I promise.
That one was pretty funny. I was laughing inside. It's weird how things happen, and I believe it's confirmation bias or reference bias. It's one of those biases, but it's that you know, you buy a Toyota Corolla and suddenly all you see is Toyota Corollas. But this whole a celebrity dying having an impact, a personal impact on a person, I was thinking about that for some reason yesterday because I've never had that happen except Elvis dying, which we talked about earlier. But I was a kid and I was like, it was the first one. And I was like, it's going to be weird. A world. And I sat there and tried to wrap my mind around the idea of there not being an Elvis walking this earth. But other than that, I've never had it. And I think it's because I've never gotten close enough to an artist to have enough of an impact until yesterday. Social D came on my phone plugged in and one of their songs came on. And I thought, I wasted a lot, and I've talked about this on Don't Panic before. I wasted a lot of years not listening to them. Finally got into them I've always wanted to be the kind of person who liked Social Distortion, but I just never got into them until about 5 years ago. We went and saw them down at the Egyptian Room, and just the rawness of Mike Ness just blew me away. I became an instant fan, and now when I listen to him, it evokes such emotions in me. And to see his face at the time, he was probably 53 54, I'm not sure exactly how old he is. I guess he started a band when he was 16 in 1972 or 3, so I could do some math, I guess, but anyway, I'm not going to. My point is, I started thinking about when he dies. I assume he will die before me. He may not. I mean, he's not that much older than me, I guess.
You never know. People have been saying that about Keith Richards for 50 years.
It's true. Well, Ness is totally off the juice, man. He's
clean.
He's been clean for a couple of decades, maybe. I don't know. But I thought he'll have that impact, not because, like, I know him or, like, I'm going to miss him because I'll still be able to listen to his music, but just the emotions that he conjures in me. I picture him, you know, having those emotions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then when he's dead, it'll be like he's not having those emotions. And it'll be harder to picture him having those emotions. And I don't know. For me, he conjures up a feeling of, I don't know, the song Story of My Life is probably the biggest one where it's kind of like hopes and dreams are just always hopes and dreams. Nothing ever turns out the way you thought it was going to turn out, you know? Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's a big bummer, but somehow it helps me to feel that regret and feel that despair, because I think his whole thing is, but life goes on.
Yeah. So catharsis is hard. First of all, it's spontaneous. You know, I don't think that anybody prepares for catharsis. Yeah. So it's not something that you can just kind of, I mean, a lot of people kind of, you know, they'll sit in their darkened basement and they'll put on, you know, Social Distortion and they'll grab a drink or whatever and they'll prepare for that moment of catharsis. But they're getting it from that. And I think it's a lot easier to go to a place like where you just went, mm-hmm. where, yeah, like, you know, you're hearing someone sing or talk, or you're reading someone say, hey, life is really hard and your hopes and dreams may only ever be those things. Mm-hmm. You may never actually grab that brass ring. And you're sitting there going, yeah, that's exactly right. That's mm-hmm. exactly, I should have figured that out for myself, or I thought that's the way it was, and now here's this other person that I trust.
Telling
me this.
That's a big thing.
And I get it, and that's your cathartic moment right mm-hmm. there. And I think art is probably the most effective driver of catharsis. Yeah. I think that if you create it yourself, it's probably something else. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that you need to have something to motivate you to go through that.
That makes sense. You know, and that sounds like some of what you were doing here.
I never had a lot. You know, most people who love Lou Reed always had a love hate relationship with Lou Reed. Mm-hmm. People don't love Lou Reed like they love, Beyonce. You know, it's not that kind of a relationship. You know, those of us who had followed him since we were kids and wanted to be, we didn't just like want to put the record on and dance to the record or listen to the record or learn the guitar parts or be in a band with that person. Mm-hmm. Like, we wanted to be part of his world. We wanted to be like, you know, we wanted to understand the part of the world that he lived in, and not mm-hmm. just as not geographically. Anybody could have gone to the brownstone he lived in the Lower East Side and hung out there on the stoop and waited for him to come home. But I think that there was a state of mind with Lou Reed. Yeah. And listening to those early records when he was really out there, Berlin and Coney Island Baby, it's just those 70s RCA records that he did were just so far beyond anything anybody else was doing from an emotional standpoint. And the thing that really got me about him was the relentless character study. And that's, I'm all about that. They're just the getting into someone's, not just in their head, getting into their DNA and ripping them apart mm-hmm. and writing a song about them. And like you understood what every character on the Berlin album, what their motivation was, what their catharsis was going to be if they hadn't had it yet, mm-hmm. and what their end was going to be. And that's right. I mean, that's fantastic writing. And I think that he was unnecessarily villainized for being a hack by a lot of people who just didn't get it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of where that whole thing about, I think that you maybe need to revisit your literacy if you're not understanding where this is coming yeah. from. Because it's obviously coming from a world that you will never understand. Mm-hmm. And even for those of us who never really got to that world, we still have that. We're still holding on to that. Maybe one day I'll really understand where he's coming from. But yeah. that's a dark path to go down. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot harder to go down that dark path than it is to go down the path of Lemonade. And that'll be my last Beyonce reference of this podcast, I promise.
I didn't even get the reference.
Just not a fan.
How did you even get that much to reference her to you?
Lemonade is her... Lemonade is her most recent.
Who in your life is into Beyonce? Are you
nobody?
You follow the music press, so you would hear about.
Yeah, that. I mean, yeah. you can't swing a dead cat, you know, without reading something about her. And she put out an album last year called Lemonade, which will probably get the best album Grammy tonight.
I see. Yeah. I see.
It's an album about. It's funny because maybe I should take a step back from that because it's funny. Mm. The album is about her her marriage.
Oh.
It's a very personal album about her husband, Jay-Z.
Jay-Z,
has
okay.
A wandering eye, and that's what the album is about.
Wandering eye? I have a wandering eye. He probably had a wandering
penis. He has a wandering penis.
Yeah.
yeah, he has wandering hands. And,
But Beyonce. That's funny. Well, she should have won that Grammy. Kanye was right.
Yeah, I do agree.
I'm going to let you finish.
Personally, I think it should have been Jethro Tull.
Oh, yeah. Jethro. Would it kill you to play a little fog hat, man?
Right.
Bring us back up with this other piece you brought.
I have a friend here in Indianapolis.
Oh, before you do that, yeah, I'm absolutely. Sorry. You're getting in the mindset. This is funny. This probably belongs on Don't Panic, but I finally watched Dirty Grandpa the other day.
I haven't seen that.
Two nights ago. It's have you seen it, Paul?
Johnny Knoxville?
No.
I've been meaning to. I haven't seen it yet.
Robert De Niro.
Okay.
Yeah, Johnny Knoxville did something like that, didn't he?
He did Grandpa.
Okay.
Like Jackass Presents Grandpa or something.
So Dirty Grandpa is better than you would think.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
I mean, it has plenty of cliches in it, but there are moments where you just go, oh, that's a little more insightful than I expected. But anyway, I had a little catharsis towards the end of it. Because, I mean, spoiler alert, but if you don't get that this is going to happen in the first 10 minutes, you're not paying attention to the movie. He helps his grandson, like, not marry this total bitch. Uh-huh. It's sort of like Bachelor Party, only instead of the bachelors, imagine a grandpa.
Okay.
You know, getting the guy not to marry this total bitch that he shouldn't marry, but, you know, marry this or go off with his other girl.
Right. But it's hard. It's a story about a septuagenarian who's imparting his wisdom onto his grandson to keep him from marrying poorly.
And he does it in a way that is completely...
De Niro. Yeah.
And by the way, Paul, did you say you saw it or you didn't see it?
I haven't seen it yet. No. Yeah. No.
Well, you should watch it just for the Aubrey Plaza sex scene.
Well, alone. Why didn't you tell me that at the beginning?
he's gonna actually start watching.
You guys can finish the show. I'll just YouTube it,
man. You don't even need to watch the movie. Just that's YouTube all, Aubrey Plaza sex scene.
That's all you had to say.
But the catharsis at the end was so he saves this guy from marrying this chick, which is an allegory for don't live a life you'll regret just to please other people, right? So I had that moment where I was like, oh, I wish I had a dirty grandpa about 35 years ago.
Yeah.
But anyway.
I was my own dirty grandpa. I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I had a very clean grandpa.
Clean grandpa.
Yeah.
So,
sorry. It was rough. It was hard growing up with a clean grandpa. I got to tell you, it inspired a lot of stuff.
It's hard out there for the privileged.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. For the white privileged.
Yeah.
Sorry. I don't have a great novel in me, nor will I ever have a great novel. I'm always threatening to write a book about the Indianapolis music scene, which would be called The Drunker I Get, The Better You Sound. I have collected some amazing stories about the music scene over the years, and I don't know what I'm ever going to do with them, but I'm not a novelist. Like I just don't have that level of storytelling in me. As much as I love character study, I need to keep it brief. I can't ever see myself putting out a 200 or 300 page book that's about one thing. I don't have the attention span. I don't read a lot of novels. So unless they're of the graphic variety, but
I love the, oh, you mean the pictures?
Yeah. Yeah. But I've always been a fan of essayists. Like I love David Sedaris and, you know, going back to when I was younger, I mean, Hunter S. Thompson was always at his best, in his early days when he was writing shorter pieces for the Chronicle and when he, you know, did things like that. And Fear and Loathing is a great book, but it's basically just a stitched together pastiche of things that happened over the course of a couple of days. And like, I always loved Charles Shar Murray and Greil Marcus, David Frick, you know, all those great music journalists from the 70s. But it was the guys that went beyond saying, you know, reviewing an album or reviewing a concert. It was the guys that got into where this is coming from, what this is about, why you should pay attention to it or why you shouldn't pay attention to it, which was always my favorite. these kind of angry writers, and there's a writer's name who I'm completely forgetting, big hero of mine, I just can't remember his name right now. I always said, well, that's what I want to do. I want to write about that. You know, I want to be that snarky music journalist that, you know, musicians come up to at the clubs and go, man, why did you write that? You know, like, why would you write something like that? And I just look at them and say, because it's fucking true, you know? So a couple of years ago, actually more than a couple, it's almost 12 years ago, I got a message from a friend of mine here in Indianapolis who's working in an office. And all he said in this message was that the guy in the cube next to him was listening to a mixed CD of 80s hair metal on endless loop, and it had been going on for a while. And he actually said, I might have to quit this job because I can't take it anymore. And he said,
just kill the guy.
What should I do? And furthermore, where did this music even come from? And I looked at that thing and I said, I'm going to answer that question. I don't know what to do to help you, but I am going to answer that question.
Excellent.
So I like went back in my brain and I started thinking about where 80s hair metal came from, because for that entire, 7 to 9 years that was going on in the 80s, I did not pay attention. During that, when all that hair metal stuff was going on, I was living in New York and everybody I knew in high school was in hair metal bands and I couldn't do it. And I went back. I went back and started listening to music from like the 50s and 60s and 70s because I couldn't deal with what was going on in the mainstream.
Right.
And of course, I was listening to things like Big Country and U2 and Madness, anything to not listen to that music.
Yeah.
And then, thankfully, at the end of the 80s, Seattle happened and we didn't have to worry about hair metal anymore because it was wiped away. But I started thinking about how did this music even happen? Because it's so poorly made and it's so hacky and it's so awful and just the visual, everything about it is bad.
Yeah.
And I wrote a 3-part answer to him about the origin of 80s hair metal, which started with a very tongue-in-cheek kind of indictment of British 80s metal, which is untouchable. You can't say something bad about Judas Priest and Iron Maiden and
no,
all those other bands.
Can't.
It's no, it's sacrilegious. So in order to set up this whole kind of, this targeted kind of assassination of 80s hair metal, I started with a less than targeted assassination of British metal. So I'll read the first part of it, which I thought was the funnier of the three. Contrary to what some of your less enlightened friends might tell you, heavy metal is not, and was never, cool. This somewhat rudimentary form of music has been darkening rock and roll's door for over 30 years now, and all that time, most people who entertain themselves with higher music, thinking monkeys playing little cymbals comes to mind, have snickered quietly at the increasingly stupid cult that continues to surround and defend this form of musical spin art. An entire culture has morphed out of this music that shuns the intellectual and puts all of its focus on aggression, speed, and volume. Heavy metal is the runaway propeller of rock and roll. The appeal of classic heavy metal is in itself understandable. A bunch of young English blokes, spotty, pasty-faced, and snotty-nosed, even in their Sunday best, conjured this music out of boredom and desperation, a communal love of comic books and Aleister Crowley, and a shared vision that somewhere in a dark and sweaty netherworld, even guys as ugly as Tony Iommi could get chicks. So was unleashed onto the world in the mid-70s the new wave of British heavy metal. The band names were like scrap paper extracts from the waste bins of Burroughs, Gibson, and a possibly opium-addicted Tolkien. Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, Saxon, Def Leppard, Eve Arden. Wait, Eve Arden was not a heavy metal band. She was a kooky TV actress from the 60s. I meant, of course, to say Kay Ballard. In a world where 20-minute opuses about fairies and unicorns were being played out in 100,000-seat football stadiums, these leather-bound and hell-bent warriors out of time were cranking out ear-splitting digestibles for a generation of kids who couldn't care less about Shastric scripture, passion plays, or poor old Aqualung. What they cared about was getting out their aggression in an environment where it was okay to get out their aggression, and they needed an appropriate soundtrack. New wave of British heavy metal bands provided that in spades. Screeching vocals, lyrics usually based on some form of satanic mythology or Arthurian legend, twin guitars locked in harmony, fast tempos, and Hammond organ players need not apply. By the late 70s, musicians were starting to get key bored. Oh, and no girls. In the world of British heavy metal, girls were for after the show. They didn't even write songs about girls. The testosterone level of this music was so high and so concentrated, girls weren't even necessary. This was 1970s Britain, and punk had just completed its 18-month whitewashing of rock and roll history. Everyone was looking forward, but the new wave of British heavy metal kept looking back, to Zeppelin, to Sabbath, to Deep Purple. In its own way, the new wave of British heavy metal kept British rock alive in the public eye. And while the hipsters in New York and London were jerking and bopping to Elvis Costello, Talking Heads, and the rest of the post-punk, new wave, no wave think tankers, an ever-widening circle of disaffected teenage boys were again growing their hair long,
dusting off their college-bound older brother's motorcycle jackets, once sticky with dried spit and putrid from the thick stank of CBGBs and Maxwell's, now aired-out pockets emptied of spent Marlboro packets. And now those kids were starting bands. Really bad bands. Really, really fucking god-awful shite bands. How they all ended up signing to major labels is still a mystery that should be rejiggered into riddle form, translated into glyph, and carved into a pyramid so it could stump the great minds of the future just as it stumps the simple mind of this writer. But something happened. As with all genres, heavy metal needed to evolve. Bands like Iron Maiden set a template that everyone in the genre copped for 10 years. Dark, brooding, loud, fast, and dark again. Metallica and Megadeth and a host of others attached themselves to the formula and added more speed and technique. Dark, brooding, louder, faster, and even darker still. That was it, and nobody tried to change it until about the early mid-80s. In America, some of the guys who were buying expensive British import vinyl of old Judas Priest albums were also really big Def Leppard fans. If Judas Priest was the Harley, Def Leppard was the Schwinn with the playing card in the spokes. The other major difference was that girls dug Def Leppard. They were cute, weren't they? They had nice hair and pretty faces, eh? Judas Priest, not so much cute. But the music was loud and aggressive, and even the most latent gayophobe knew deep down what the leather was really for. And a few of the same guys figured out that they could play aggressive and loud music, but by softening up the look a little bit, still pull the birds. So, in the great American male tradition of doing anything and everything within metaphysical possibility to get laid, 80s American hair metal was born.
Slow clap.
That's right.
There are two other parts of that that get really, really nasty. I'm pretty, like, that's me kind of like at my almost nastiest, but the other two parts of that, I'm like afraid to show them to people because they're so, they're just like, these guys are just like, they're not even human anymore. Oh, like, I just completely dehumanize them. They're just these anthropomorphic blobs with guitars.
Wow.
Thank you for letting me read that. That was cathartic.
That was great.
The runaway propeller was a perfect metaphor.
Thank you. You should draw that.
But I actually consider that a good thing, but that's just me.
Oh, man. You just described, we've talked about music a lot in our early influences, of which I had none. But I didn't participate at all in the 80s hair metal thing either. Paul didn't.
No.
I don't think.
The closest I came was Whitesnake, and that's only because Coverdale had been in Deep Purple.
Yeah.
So, but when but in the heat of the hair was when I tuned up for my Whitesnake. So there you go.
The most confusing thing for me in those days, having only old country as my musical heritage, is just country and just not even old like Hank Williams and stuff. Like, a little bit of that crept in, but Conway Twitty, George Jones, those guys is the only thing my parents listened to.
Conway Twitty, that's hair country.
That's hair country.
Yes,
that's right.
Yes, it's not
hair metal.
Except that duet with Dolly Parton. That was boob country. So the thing that always confused me was it always seemed like there were one or two bands that people were, that I was supposed to like. And then I would find out I wasn't. So, for example, Guns N' Roses. Andy, I still remember when Andy brought Guns N' Roses to the circle and says, "Have you heard this yet? This is awesome." And I was like, wait, they look like hairband guys. Am I supposed to like them or not supposed to like them? But he loved them,
yeah.
I guess.
I think they were crap. Yeah.
They were, I didn't, you know, looking back and listening to it now, I don't hear any difference between them and...
That's so pretentious and so dishonest.
Poison.
Yeah, know? Music is so dishonest. Yeah. And usually, just to be diplomatic, I would say, okay, I totally get why people are into Axl and Slash, but I just can't be that diplomatic. I just don't get it. I never got it. I never understood the appeal of that band.
Did you know Slash is of African descent?
I did know that.
Yeah. There's a reason to like him right there.
Well, I guess I'm a racist because I don't like Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, right? You would seem a lot cooler.
They're the whitest band in history. Yeah.
Is that why he wore that
whiter
hat,
than Wham?
The sunglasses or the hat or whatever hid most of his face.
Probably.
He didn't want people to know he was.
I think it's just because he's ugly.
Yeah, that could be.
Yeah,
that could be. You know, you told us that
I do have a heart. I do have.
You have to get to your next interview.
I have to get to, right. It's like the Tonight Show.
Your people. Your people back. Are waving at me from over there.
I have to get back to Vegas. I have three shows at the Sands tonight. So.
Well, we're going to take a little break here, and I'll help you find your way out. But let me tell you, this is episode 3, and this is exactly the kind of thing I was hoping for.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah. And just think of it this way, and this is not advice or anything. I'm just saying, imagine how great the show would be if you did it the way that we did it today, but with an actual writer.
Oh.
Instead of just a pretend writer. So I'm like the guinea pig. Like, I'm on the wheel turning and I'm reading stuff that I wrote when I was like 35 years old. Look at all the funny, snarky stuff I wrote about music. You're like a real, like a novelist. I can hook you up with a great novelist.
Really? Actually. Please.
Yeah. There's this guy named Press Maxim. You should reach out to him.
Cool name.
And he wrote an amazing, amazing novel that he worked for years on. And I'll get you all of his information. And he's been on our show and he's a really, really good dude. He's like this local, like, raconteur, great storyteller. He's very funny. He plays the accordion while he's talking to you about his book.
Ooh,
and nice. he's a really good dude, and he would love to do something like this.
Oh, good.
Because we only gave him like 12 minutes on the radio hour. You knew that he just wanted to do more.
We'll let him read forever.
Yeah, yeah.
And Dave Marsh too. We got to get Dave Marsh as well.
Yeah.
He finally finished his novel.
Yeah, and I got to get you a copy of Press's book. It's really
please
fun.
Do. Yeah, please. Absolutely. That, and you did the thing you're always supposed to do when you're networking. I'm supposed to ask who else should we talk to, but you preempted my question by giving me the answer.
Yeah, I jumped in.
Perfect. Okay.
Can I do a shameless plug?
Please. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I have a radio, I have a podcast that I do called the Do It Indie Radio Hour.
Oh, have I heard
and
of
you
that?
Can go, yeah, have you heard of that? Mm-hmm. You can go to doitindieradiohour.com. That's our new website, and we are a podcast, and you can subscribe to us on through the iTunes store, and our new episodes will show up in your little feed there. And we're doing our 150th episode. Today's Sunday. Tomorrow's Monday. We're doing our 150th episode tomorrow.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I can't believe we made it this far.
150. Do yourself a favor out there. Go check it out. It's if you like music, if you like local music, if you like listening to quality blather, it's a fantastic show. Doitindieradiohour.com.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, and you know what? If you go to the website, there's actually a link to a bunch of stuff that I wrote for a website called Weeping Elvis. And there's an article I wrote for them about Kiss, which is very much like the one that I just read. And stuff about local music. There's like a link to my blog. So yeah, check it out. Let me know what you think. Maybe I'll start writing again.
Fantastic.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate this.
Thank you for being on.
Cheers.
So for MP Cavalier and Paul Schultz, I'm Steve Vinson. This has been the Rough Draft podcast. Don't forget to check out doitindieradiohour.com for more on MP. And don't forget to check out don'tpanicradioshow.com for our other labor of love. Any parting words, Mr. Paul?
No, I think I can't possibly come up with anything as insightful as he did earlier. So,
true. All right. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you think it, write it down. I figure I have to try a bunch of them.
Yeah, we need to work on that one.
If it sounds good, write it. Wait, yeah. If it smells good, eat it.